My question for people is like, when there's a question of like, how should I, is it time for me to be still? Is it time for me to keep working? If you don't get your work done today, or if you don't do what's on the calendar today, or what does that mean about you at the end of the day? Who are you if that doesn't get done? And if the answer really is, I'm good, and I'm a child of God, and I'm good in my identity, you're probably in a pretty good place for it.
Wow.
But most people that I talk to, it means that there's something bad about me that I didn't get this done.
Mm.
That any of these messages that I hear in my ears, any of these tapes that are playing, they're actually true.
Mm.
And I'm not really worth it. I'm not really a man. And I'm not. So I have to do this. Otherwise, all of this bad stuff is true about me. If there is any sense inside of you that that's the truth, I think it's time to be quiet.
What's going on, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The White Flag. I'm your host, Jonathan Moynihan, and today I'm joined by a very special guest in person, all the way from Colorado. His name is Chris Moser, and he is like a founder and executive director of Liminal, this incredible organization we're going to talk about. He is a musician. He has done tours with some very big worship artists from the 90s and 2000s, I do have to say, including my parents' favorite, Stephen Curtis Chapman. Right. Shout out to you, man. And he's also the composer of children's party theme, Pirates. I went and looked up some of his discography.
I don't think that's true. I don't even know what that is.
Listen, I looked online, and it said, kids' party theme, Pirates, Chris Moser. So,
I've never heard of that before. I swear probably, to God, I don't know.
Probably
what that
a false attribution, but dude. He's also just a larger-than-life man, by the way. Incredibly in shape. Handsome as always.
I'm tall.
Fellow redhead, Chris Moser. Thanks for being on the podcast, dude.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I looked that up, and it's like, this looks totally backwards, but I'm just going to bring it up and see what it is.
All I'll tell you, I don't know what that is.
No memory of it.
But I did spend a bunch of years doing library music, so just writing, like composing generic music that would get used in the background for TV and for... And I never know what ends up happening with that stuff.
So maybe that was it, then.
It could be. I don't know.
So my first question is, how come all like the 90s worship guys needed to have three names?
That's a great question.
Michael W. Smith, yep. Stephen Curtis. Was that like a thing?
I think.
Like, do you remember? Did you feel pressure to include your middle name as an artist?
I felt pressure to go the other way. I always thought it was cooler to have one name.
Yeah.
So
just Bono.
Yeah, that was the one. If I could have been Cher.
Moser.
If I could have been Cher, I would have been Cher.
Cher. That's funny, dude. All right, next one. Who's the bigger sinner, Casting Crowns or Stephen Curtis Chapman? Just kidding. You don't have to answer that. Because you toured with both or played with both?
I did Casting Crowns' first album.
Cool.
But that was a time, so I lived in Nashville at the time and I had home studio. I never met them.
Oh, so you'd be on albums.
So I would.
But you're not necessarily in the room with them.
And internet was like in its infancy.
Yeah.
So a courier would show up at my front door with a hard drive, and I would go and record a bunch of stuff.
A courier.
And then call him back and have him pick it up. That was how it worked.
You basically had like an owl appear to your door, Harry Potter
I'm
world.
I'm going to answer that. I assume that they're the bigger sinners, though, because they were a band and there were more of them.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
More, yeah.
Can't say anything bad about Stephen Curtis Chapman. He's the GOAT. I grew up listening to Stephen Curtis Chapman albums with my parents. They loved him. Glad.
Yep. A friend of mine used to play with Glad.
Yeah. I mean, like, the Glad Christmas album, I've lost half the people listening already. We're going to move on. But my parents would play that all the time. All right. So, Chris, we had Sherry Marbois on months ago.
The amazing,
huge presence of a person in a tiny little package.
That's how it works.
And she was great. We talked about soul work. She even like did a process on me in the middle of the show.
Heard a little bit about
which
that.
Was very intimidating. But so I'm kind of ready for that in case that happens today. But you know, you and her both have been pioneers in launching this organization called Liminal. So give me like the SparkNotes version of what it is, what you do, how'd you get into it. So let's start with what it is and what you do.
So it's a great question. I think what when you ask that, what I do in particular or what Liminal does?
I think more so what Liminal does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good question because it's kind of a more ethereal answer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I've realized since launching Luminal, since starting this and doing something, my background is more specifically with men's work.
Okay.
And one of the things I realized is it was important to me when we started Liminal that I was doing it with Sherry and that we were doing something that was co-ed, that we were, but it's still something where I'm working specifically with men and she's working specifically with women.
Okay.
And as soon as I started talking globally about soul work and for everybody, I became super tongue-tied. I'm so used to speaking to men about men's work. And I think a lot of my background, a lot of my talent with that is working with men in that kind of capacity. And then as soon as I'm talking co-ed and I'm including women with it, it's like I feel like I have to be careful or I have to like watch what I'm saying or something. And it's like I can't speak about it in the same kind of the same kind of power. So if I start,
because your experience isn't specific, because the dynamics of caring for women in that space is different than men, and your training is obviously like. With men in the work,
the main thing that I do with men, the starting point that I have with men is usually around initiation, which sounds a little strange, but it's this the idea that we're one of the only cultures that's lost this idea that somehow we have to intentionally bring boys into manhood.
Okay, keep going. Talk about that more. Because I know what you're saying, but I don't think that's a concept that's discussed much.
Well, yeah,
just out in like normal world life,
right? And in Western culture, and
yes.
in Christianity specifically, it's one of the things that's been lost. So it does. It seems very mysterious, but it's something. Even the thing that always fascinates me about it is, in any culture, and we're talking, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah,
there would be some. Almost primal thing that just happens that every culture will have this way of saying, okay, once boys reach a certain age, we've got to teach them how to be men. And we've got to have something, some kind of like line in the sand that when they cross this, now we're going to come back to them and say, now you are a man. And any of, you know, usually in tribal cultures and things, there'd be a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
That would go along with that. So now you're ready for this, and now we're going to give this to you.
And they oftentimes the gateway to that label of manhood is painful,
right?
Chaotic,
yeah.
You know, uncertain. Like you know, there's tribes in Africa that involves cutting
absolutely.
The face.
Yeah, there's usually in almost all of them there's some type of scarring or some type of wounding that goes along with it.
Yeah.
The scarring. There's one of them. Literally, it's usually their parent. It's usually their father that would do it. But they would cut their forehead, and if they winced, if they give any kind of you know jarring or anything that goes along with that, they're not men. So they're taken seriously. The crazy thing about it, though, is that the patterns of initiation, they would be very similar or almost the same from in tribal cultures all over the world with no communication. Between any of them, this is just something that would like instinctively happen.
It's like anthropological, like yes, it's deeply exactly. within what it means to be human that there was this need to transfer someone into like a new stage of life, a new stage of authority.
And kind of fast forwarding, we look at a culture that we live in now. My experience working with a lot of men is the one question that's similar with just about every man that I talk to is some variation of, "Am I man enough?"
Yeah. Well, I've heard some sociologists talk about like the postponement or postponing of like adulthood. And that's why we're getting more and more young men who are 28, 29, and they may be living on their own, having a job and having money, but they still don't feel like men.
Yes.
There's like this continuation of boyhood beyond the years that our ancestors would have ever functioned at.
Yep. Yeah. And so this rebringing in some type of initiation process. And we do this with weekends where there's a challenge for men and to be able to face something, get to the other side of it and have a community around them saying, yeah, for them to be able to affirm now you're a man and for men to walk away with that real sense inside of them, that question's gone, I am a man.
Yeah.
The danger with this, I mean, not the danger with the weekends, but the danger with living with that question, and I'm not crazy about this terminology.
Okay.
Mostly because what's turned into and what it's become. But
sure.
The idea of toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
What toxic masculinity is supposed to mean, where it came from, a guy named Shepard Bliss, a professor that came up with this term, I think back in the 80s.
Hmm.
It was supposed to mean it's talking about a behavior that is displayed by men when they have this question, when they're not fully embracing their full masculinity. They'll do damaging type of behaviors in ways of trying to prove to themselves that they are men.
Mm.
Rather
wow.
than being able to step into a full masculinity
yeah.
and not have to prove anything anymore by doing something damaging or doing Whoa. Something hurtful for other people.
Yeah, so it's when it was originally coined, what you're saying is toxic masculinity occurred when they actually weren't being in the full masculine.
Exactly.
And it was like almost a dilution or cheap, shallow version of masculinity.
Yeah.
And it was manifesting in stuff going sideways and, you know, like exploitation or unwarranted aggression. But the traits of masculinity weren't problematic. It was actually when you weren't stepping in the fullness of it that it became problematic.
Right.
And now, obviously, the conversation has shifted to
yeah, exactly.
Power is inherently bad.
And there's a my daughter turned me on to this YouTube channel called Cinema Therapy. I don't know if you've ever heard
no,
of it.
No, no.
It's fantastic. It's a therapist, licensed therapist, and
okay.
a movie director.
Okay.
And they analyze characters in movies, and they look at movies, and they take
I'm looking this up. This sounds awesome.
And they analyze somebody based on it, and it's fantastic. And I can't remember the therapist's name, but they did one episode on toxic masculinity. He said he didn't like the term because it doesn't quite describe what it actually is. And
mm-hmm.
He prefers the term limiting masculinity. And he said that, and a light bulb just went
yeah,
off for me. I was like, that's perfect. It's,
yeah.
it's all of there are things that culturally we are taught as men are not masculine. So if we actually feel all of our feelings or are in touch with our feelings or anything, we'll get some messages culturally that's feminine, that's not masculine. So it's like, stay away from that. When actually, no, that's a big part of our masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
But we're limiting ourselves and our masculinity by not embracing those things.
Yeah.
So if we get these, you know, these messages, you know, boys don't cry, we're weak if you're crying, anything like that, we end up like cutting that part of ourselves off.
Yeah.
Or thinking that if I do that, somehow I'm not being a man. So we're kind of pulling ourselves and limiting ourselves from our full selves.
But when you cut that off and you continue it out for 15 years, that's how you do get toxic expressions, because you're actually not
right.
being the fully masculine, which is the poetic warrior, like the everything.
Absolutely.
And like the there's a book about a samurai, something, the 12 rings, but it was a samurai who took on 60 men and killed them all himself with his own sword, like one of the greatest samurais of all time.
Okay.
But every day he wrote poetry.
Yep.
He'd make tea. He was a gardener. Like, it was like this full masculine expression, deeply romantic, also a savage with the sword.
Right.
And almost picturing that as the fullness of masculinity, as opposed to that, hey, we don't feel, we don't cry, so go be a man. And
Absolutely.
That's where all this damaging stuff comes from.
Yeah. And I like to look at, on our weekends,
we'll
use David as one of the models when we talk about this also, as a king, as a warrior, as a poet at the same time, as a musician, as someone
yeah.
that, like, in celebration, he would start to dance and he would have this freedom of expression in that kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And he screwed up a lot also, which is,
yeah.
you know, had to learn from those things also. So
yeah.
there's a lot to learn there.
Yeah. If you were trying to, I don't want to like put you on the spot, but if you're trying to summarize that original thought of what toxic masculinity was coined for, and maybe how that rubs up against like the modern narrative around it, how would you try to like communicate that to somebody? Like, what's the big difference here of what you're getting at?
One of my issues there's with social media and with ways things like blurbs kind of get put
yeah.
out there and phrases get kind of tossed around.
Yeah.
One of the issues that I have with just communication in general these days is a lot of terms get thrown out with no definition.
Yeah.
And I think when toxic masculinity,
we're using the same words but not the same definitions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's also almost an assumption when I say this that you'll just know what it means when you're the way that you hear it might
yeah.
be different, and suddenly we're trying to talk
yes.
and we're saying completely different things.
Yeah.
And toxic masculinity is one of those phrases that I think as the Me Too movement started rising, and then this word, this term started getting thrown around, there was a lot of assumption that it just means. And I think a lot of that is that masculinity itself is somehow toxic.
Yeah,
that it's that there's something bad in being a man or in our masculine nature, which is not what it's supposed to mean. Mm-hmm. It's actually just the opposite. It's like, no, if we fully embrace our masculinity, that's going to stop us then from this toxic behavior in our lives. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the healing from that, I think, is for men to fully embrace their masculinity and to really understand what that means. But that also means going to some places that might be some pretty scary places for men to go, especially in the face of, you know, culturally what we've been taught a man is. I always think there's like this image, you know, when I speak to men and I already know what it is. Like if you just close your eyes and you're picturing like, what does it mean to be a man? What's the true picture of masculinity? It's like, we all have this like same image in our heads, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a false image of what masculinity really is.
It's beautiful. Well said.
That men always have to have the right answer. That we're stoic, that we're that we're strong in the face of anything. We'll never show any fear. We'll never show any sadness about anything. And I just don't think that's how God meant masculinity to be. I think it's much, much more than that. And a lot of those things are good things.
Yes.
So being stoic is not a bad thing. Having the right answer for something is not a bad thing. But if that's all we are, it's very limiting.
Yeah. So on the weekends, you're essentially creating an environment to have an initiation process into manhood where you get to model and outline and give tools to men to step into the fullness of that masculinity, the king side of themselves, the warrior, you know, the wise sage, and then like the lover, which is, you know, my judgment is the average American male, that lover side, it's either ramped up, you know, like modern culture kind of says, hey, be full lover all the time. Don't have any warrior. But, you know, my generation and maybe a little older, they didn't come up with that paradigm. It was more so like, be all warrior, no lover. So we shut off our emotions. But you're trying to raise up all of those levers, because when a man is all of those things, then they are powerful and loving and safe and tenacious, all of it, not just
absolutely one extreme. And I think, you know, and I always liken these things to heart, mind, soul, and strength.
Yes.
Oddly, I mean, where that warrior, that strength, that piece seems to be more of where I would think men would be going. I see men more locking themselves into their minds these days, and wanting to understand everything, wanting to have the answer for everything. But there's a control aspect there. So like wanting to have all control over every situation that I'm in, and there's usually kind of a self-protection piece that goes along with that.
Yeah.
So even connection with our own bodies and connection with that seems to be a stretch for a lot of men in America these days. It's surprising to me that even getting to that warrior side of things can sometimes be a challenge for men.
Because it's physical, it requires all of you.
It's physical, and there's a strength component, and there's a risky component to having to step into something a little wilder too.
Yeah. Well, we live in this information age where, you know, power and capacity is often wrapped up in how smart are you, how much do you know.
Yeah.
And we live in the information age where like the amount of information in the world doubles every 12 hours. So we don't have a lot of needs to like build shelter or find food. You know, like the economy in which we operate within is all information based.
That's a great
point. So why would I really need to like flex those things? And you know, it's like we like the mind and the strength, but the heart and the soul, we kind of, you know, the really lame 90s metaphor for me, it's like you can't get Captain America with only two of the, or Captain Planet, you can't get Captain Planet with only two of the rings. You got to have all the rings to have like, you know, wind, water, heart, all that crap.
Yeah.
But, okay. So you help men experience that stuff. You equip them with tools. I know that, you know, there's a lot more we could talk about the organization, but the... And we can kind of push people to that and put that in the show notes later on the back end and talk a little bit more at the end about what kind of next steps could people take if they want to dive into some of the soul work.
But because it sounds so attractive for me to put it out there right now, right?
Well, you said something that really sets me up for one of the next things I wanted to ask you, which was when we say soul work, and I use that language sometimes on the show.
Yep.
Like I can see the analytics of the show. So twice a month, I do like a monologue episode where we dive into like a practice, with Jesus. And it's just reflecting on things or me processing what I'm learning and being an imperfect model as people try to grow.
Yeah, yeah.
Then once a month, it's about an interview. And then once a month, it is a guided meditative episode where we pray through a psalm. And it's like me talking for 5 minutes and then for 25 minutes having like I guide you a little bit. Those are consistently the least consumed episode, but it's the one I get most excited about doing because it's a chance to like step up to the plate for some of the soul work. But something you said that I really love is you talked about like men are so in their head and they keep things locked up there. And so soul work to someone who's maybe not familiar with it, that sounds like it's just a head thing. Like, okay, I'm going to think in my head, I'm going to dive deep in within myself, and it's just my mind, just my body, not even my body, just my mind and like my ethereal spirit, almost like Gnosticism, where like the flesh is bad, the spirit is good, I'm just going to connect with God that way. But having done soul work and you being an architect of creating environments for men to do this, can you unpack a little bit how soul work is not that? Like it is not just and everything's internal and it's fine. You know what I mean? Like help the person who maybe has heard me talk about it and they trust me or they trust people I've had, but it feels like it's just I'm diving into myself and it's all ethereal and nothing manifests from it. Just talk, man.
Let me start by saying I think soul work, one of the things that makes soul work difficult to talk about is it's another one of those phrases that's kind of loosely defined.
Yeah, that's good.
And I'm okay with that, actually. I think when I think about soul work a little bit more technically, I think about more specifically a spiritual journey piece.
Okay.
Where with Liminal and the work we do with Liminal, there's an emotional piece to it also that we include with that. We do a lot of emotional work, right? Where technically, like, so I have a couple of good friends that are spiritual directors that do a lot of the monastic stuff that you're talking about, which I really love. And I think more technically, I think that has its own kind of bucket.
Sure.
And soul work, technically, I would usually think of in that.
Yeah.
But in our own definition, there's this emotional work and more of the self-discovery piece and more even psychological aspects of things that I would also include in soul work.
Yeah.
Part of my background, I grew up in the Catholic Church. My parents were both musicians in the Catholic Church. Also, my mom was a cantor. And for those of you who don't know anything,
I didn't know the Catholic Church had musicians.
and song leader. So cantor was the song leader.
Okay.
One of my mom's gifts was, she could get a crowd to sing.
Let's go.
And it's very different in the Catholic Church because there's so much chant.
Yeah.
And there's so many like call and response type of songs that are done. And she could like sing her part of it and then have this way of like lifting her hand and having everybody respond.
Singing.
And it was great. I left the Catholic Church. I was just talking with someone about this the other day, so it's kind of fresh out of my mind. In high school, as a high school kid, wanted to be more involved with social group kind of stuff. And, and there was a friend that went to a Presbyterian church that was down the street, and their high school group was much more active. So they had more Bible study kind of stuff going on that I was interested in, so I started getting involved with that. And then kind of went down that path. And it wasn't until years later that I really went back to the Catholic Church. And I've never gone back and rejoined a church or anything like that, but realized what it was about Catholicism and things, there are pieces of it that I really enjoyed and that I really missed. And that so much of it was built on liturgy and ritual. That those are pieces that I missed in the other churches that I was then going to. And the thing about ritual is there's an action that has to go into it.
Yeah.
And there's they're all designed and meant for, this is our time as Christians to actually do a practice.
Yes.
And there's something about even that word and knowing that my spiritual life is something to practice, not just something to think about. I love the idea of being taught the Bible and having pastors that have done a bunch of study and have some wonderful thoughts and being able to talk that, but you know, the danger on the other side of it is the consumeristic aspect of sitting in a chair and having everybody do everything for me, where most of the soul work stuff we're talking about is actually my chance to practice and my chance to do and work my spiritual life rather than just have it. I think there's even some mental concepts of like just the way we do things in the constructs in which we're doing them.
Yeah.
That really teach us that somehow spiritual life is just going to happen. Or if I think through it enough, it's a very, even the thought of prayer is a very passive approach to things, right?
Sure.
Rather than, and I'm already.
You mean like people are saying people view prayer as passive because it's like, oh, I'm not doing anything. Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
I'll think through this, and I don't even know I don't even know how to do this because I don't know how to converse with God in this. But I'm just going to sit here, and maybe something will happen.
Yeah.
But there's something about the practice of reading a scripture in a certain way and seeing how God is speaking to me through it, but actually having to go through that practice on the worship side of things. I remember years ago being introduced to Taizé services.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or not, but it's Taizé is a town in France where this came out of, which is what it's named from, but it's a prayer service. And I was, as a worship leader, as a music director, I was really getting burned out on corporate worship, the way that that it was done. And a friend recommended I go check this out. And it's very self-led. I remember walking in the doors and the music would just, the half hour leading up to the start of the service is silence. So everybody's just kind of waiting in there, just in silence, waiting for things to start. And then a song comes out of it. And the songs are mostly written in a very simple format. So they're 4 to 8 bars, and they're just kind of, they turn into these chants that just loop.
And coming from your musical background, you know, from a musical standpoint, someone who's uninitiated with this could think, wow, this is boring.
That's exactly what
happened. Wow, what a boring song.
We hit the third loop of this, and I'm like, is this going somewhere? Is this good? But the interesting thing happened that, I mean, the lyrics don't change. There's not multiple verses or anything. Once I got it, I didn't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was just doing this. I was singing this song, but I wasn't having to think about it. And my thoughts could be more on where I was with God in the midst of this of this practice of just doing this song.
That's great.
And they would let these things go for a while. And then another song would start, and we'd go through that, and then there'd be a reading, and we'd sing a little bit more. And then the interesting thing happened was one song ended, and then nothing happened. And with my church background and all the programming and everything,
tight transitions. What's going on?
I look around, like somebody's getting fired.
Right? Someone screwed up.
And like a minute went by, and I realized I'm a slow learner. I admit
it's all good, dude.
I went.
That's funny.
Oh, this is supposed to be happening right
now.
Wow.
Yeah.
There was 5 minutes of silence in the midst of this service.
Beautiful.
And then out of 5 minutes, another song would start. And it was just simple.
Yeah.
But again, it was this, it was a bunch of people coming together. And this was in Oak Park, just outside of Chicago. It was a beautiful church. And so there were about 1,000 people there. And doing this simple practice. But again, it felt like getting back to a practice of worship. Rather than, and again, with my background, so much of my job was in music and worship also.
Yeah.
But being able to let go of some of that and actually, again, getting back to doing.
Yeah.
And even as I'm saying that, I know, you know, when we started this off and you talked about the stillness and the letting go of things, there's still this duality and this balance of feeling like there's a practice of doing and then learning how to be at the same time.
Yeah.
And this tension in the middle of that I'm always feeling and never knowing, like, I think so much of our culture is also driven by, like, okay, what's the right way to do this?
Yeah.
Am I doing this right or am I doing this wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm always in the middle of that going, like, I don't know, man.
Yeah, dude. Man, that's so good, though. I mean, so much I'd want to say after everything you just shared. Because, like, I'll go on probably about once a year, like a spiritual retreat with like a monastic tradition, and, you know, for 2 days or something. Or I did 72 hours in silence in 2020, and then last year I did a retreat where you're allowed to speak at certain points, but much of like the services were just very boring songs, and then you're quiet. And a couple things that you said that triggered some things for me was like, silence is really interesting, but when you're in a room of 1,000 people and there's silence, there's something divine about that.
Absolutely.
Like, it's easy to have silence with like 3 people in a room, but when you have 1,000, it feels so foreign in like the human sphere of our existence, and it heightens your sense of divinity because it's like, oh, only before a living God would 1,000 people be quiet. And then the other thing you're talking about that I'm really resonating with is, you know, the language. I use the phrase like spiritual practices a lot because spiritual disciplines has some baggage for like the millennial Gen X context, you know, like, oh, spiritual discipline sounds boring or bad, you know, discipline's bad. And obviously it's not true, but practices, what you're talking about, like allowing the body to practice soul work. I think that's brilliant because, and I've never thought of it this way until you said this, doing the practices makes it so that when it's game time, you actually can function well.
Right.
Like in normal world, when you played your keys for 10,000 hours, that practice made it so you were prepared for the performance or for the display of whatever. And there is an element of soul work and spiritual practices and rhythms that we talk about on the show where you're almost equipping your soul and your body and your mind and your heart to function healthily in the ways of Jesus when it's most needed.
Yeah.
Like when you have a kid and are now responsible for the spiritual well-being of another child, or when there's trauma in a relationship, or when there's an illness. You know, like those people that handle those big shifts the best, I think are the ones who've done the practice so that they're not shocked when they're in the game.
I agree.
And obviously, the game of life isn't just when bad things happen. It could be beautiful things too. But that the angle you just talked about of soul work being like a place to practice, that's really riveting. That's really interesting.
Well, and I somewhere
never thought of it like that.
Somewhere in here, and this goes to some other things we were talking about even a little bit earlier, is in that practice is also a centering of who I am. And there's a big identity piece in here also.
Mm-hmm. Who I really am.
Who I really am.
Yeah.
And who I am in Christ.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of a lot of these practices are to center us in who we really are. And we're living in a culture, especially now, where so much of our own identity can, there are so many other places where our identity can be formed, but it's usually in what we do rather than in who we are.
Yeah.
And that's where when we talk about these practices being more about being rather than doing, I think that's more about recentering our identity in being and in who we are in Christ rather than what we do.
That's great. So one of the things you and I were talking about before hitting record.
Yeah.
Is this very practical felt need that comes up often when it comes to soul work and monastic practices, silence, stillness. It's that tension of, I know that I should probably model the way of Jesus and go pray and be still. Like I get those things conceptually. But then the pushback, especially in America, in a fast-paced Western, you know, major urban environment like a Denver or, you know, Baltimore, DC corridor, it's that side of, okay, I can't go just do that all the time. I've got problems to solve, things to do, dreams to accomplish. I got to get going. We'll do it again. I got dreams to do, problems to solve, all those things. And so you talk to like that tension. It's a balance of like, should I go be still now or should I go get working? Like, should I go do things? Because the people who resist the practice I talk about tend to be the ones who are type A, let's go get it. I got some stuff to do. Yes, I'm praying. I even have a good friend of mine who listens, who's like, yeah, I pray for like 5 minutes with God tonight. I feel great and I'm good and I got to go solve some stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's good. But can you talk for a little bit about that, about navigating that well, like that really big felt need of how do I prioritize both, you know, running after, I mean, there's so many things we could do here because you talked about like the centering that happens,
right,
which I think is like an auditing method of like, do I need to get going right now?
That's a good way of putting it.
Or do I need to be still, which I don't think most people take the time to evaluate. But what have you seen in leading soul work and your own story of how do I figure out when I'm supposed to be still with Jesus and when am I supposed to get going? Knowing that those could change every day. But I think that's a really big felt need people feel of the mom with three kids.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I know I'm supposed to rest with Jesus. I also need to make sure my children have food today for school.
Absolutely. Or that sounds like a good thing.
Right? Yeah. Like, you know, my friend is a business owner and he's like, okay, I know I want to like spend time with God and I want to adopt some of these things, but I also have like 300 employees now that I'm responsible for caring for and I can't just go do blank. My judgment is, I think when you're talking about centeredness, you're not necessarily talking about like physical. There's a centeredness that can occur even in the midst of moving because it's more than just sit, be stoic. But yeah. I don't know, dude. I'm just rambling here.
I want to fully own.
Ramble
before,
with me.
before I start rambling.
Okay.
So this organization, Liminal.
Yeah.
We just got it launched just before COVID hit.
Great timing.
It was a great plan.
Thanks, Holy Spirit.
That was wonderful. and really, with our nonprofit and everything, just put everything officially in place just in in the last 4 or 5 months.
Mm.
And so Sherry and I just stepped in as co-executive directors of the nonprofit.
Great.
And from the moment that I stepped into that role, all of my spiritual practices have gone
like, went out the window
completely.
Yeah.
I under everything you're saying.
This is a very real tension for you.
Understand.
Wow, dude. Thanks for sharing that. That's real.
The amount of, you know, seeing things go onto my calendar and the schedule keeps getting crazier and crazier.
Texts, phone calls, everything.
As much as I do this work, I'm struggling with the same thing.
Yeah.
And I know the importance of it, and I also see the importance of needing to make sure that work gets done, right?
Yeah.
One of the things we had talked about a little bit earlier, I want to bring up, and I think is one of the fears that I see the most in men when they start to do this work, they come on a weekend and start looking and investigating some stuff into themselves.
Yeah.
One of the pushbacks that I get is if I get to a place where I'm okay being peaceful, or if I lose this nagging voice that's in my ear all the time, that's always saying something bad about me, that I'm afraid I'm going to lose my motivation to keep achieving and keep getting my stuff done.
Yeah. In order for me to become who you're saying, I'm actually going to have to lose what I've built almost.
Right.
It's like you feel like you have to sacrifice some things.
A lot of the baggage that we carry around in life can sometimes, there's benefits we get from it too. And that's a lot of the reason that sometimes we'll continue carrying it because it'll motivate us to want to do better. It'll motivate us to want to show somebody or like prove ourselves in some kind of way.
Wow. The baggage benefits you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And so
even though we complain about it.
Yeah.
Oh, man, this is holding me back.
There's a risk of letting go of it.
There's a risk of letting it go. Wow.
And my hope, I guess my question, going back to what you were asking, my question for people is like when there's a question of like, how should I, is it time for me to be still? Is it time for me to keep working? If you don't get your work done today, or if you don't do what's on the calendar today, or what does that mean about you at the end of the day?
Well,
who are you if that doesn't get done?
Yeah.
And if the answer really is I'm good and I'm a child of God and I'm good in my identity, but a couple of people aren't going to get their paychecks, so I'd really like to get this done. You're probably in a pretty good place for it.
Wow.
But most people that I talk to, it means that there's something bad about me that I didn't get this done.
Mm.
That any of these messages that I hear in my ears, any of these tapes that are playing, they're actually true.
Mm.
And I'm not really worth it. I'm not really a man. And I'm not, so I have to do this. Otherwise, all of this bad stuff is true about me. If there is any sense inside of you that that's the truth, I think it's time to be quiet. And because that's where it's like your identity is not in the right place. Your identity is more in what you do. And that's not going to take you very far. And it's going to end up hurting you rather than helping you. And that's my hope for people, my hope for men specifically, when they're dealing with that, is that we can actually let go of the negative motivation of that and the pain that we're holding on to, realign ourselves with who we are in the eyes of God. Mm-hmm. So that then we can continue doing what we want to do, but because we want to do it, not mm-hmm. because we have to do it because we'll be bad if we don't do it.
Yeah. Really well said. Does that make sense? Totally did. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because the story of Jesus, when you really plow through the four gospels, like if you try to do it in 30 days or like a really quick thing, you just see this constant emphasis of Christ on like the heart motivations, you know, and it's, you know, prayer or even public prayer isn't bad. Giving isn't bad. Right. You know, like when Jesus says, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And in the same like book, he also says, let your good deeds shine for the world to see. Right. So they may work, praise your heavenly Father. He's never really nitpicking the, what the hands are doing as much as he's nitpicking why are the hands doing them? And that's getting back to the heart.
Right.
And on the flip side then, you know, the person who is go, 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 if you take the time to evaluate with a moment of quiet of what message is going to come online if I don't do this, mm-hmm. that's a great question that has to be centered. What advice would you have for maybe the inverse of that, the person who maybe is less inclined to activity, mm-hmm. who likes to just sit and be still and almost embraces that like modern evangelical transcendent faith that, oh, my faith is up here, it's for me, but there's maybe they struggle to get going or engage the body. Like that was a really helpful tool you just gave.
Yeah.
Is there an inverse tool for people with a different inclination?
That's a great question. I hadn't.
Because Andy Stanley says it's harder to tell someone to pause. It's easier to tell someone to stop and give them a break than it is to take someone who doesn't move and tell them to get moving.
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, it's obviously that's like a leadership ministry principle, but like I'm trying to think through what is like it's like the soul or spirit angle there for someone to audit their centeredness, because there's a chance you could just be sitting on your hands.
Absolutely.
And not partnering in the mission of Jesus to do what he called you to do.
And I may have resembled that at times in my life.
Yeah, I think we bounce between those two extremes, yeah, right?
I have a couple of thoughts. I don't really have a direct, like right now do this kind of,
yeah, sure.
kind of response. One is those are times where I like to look at where our, you know, when we talk about initiation, mm-hmm. We do initiation weekends and things. And I had a pastor friend of mine who really loved the process of initiation weekends. And the one issue that he had, and I've really tried to teach this harder since he brought it up, is that he doesn't want people to get the impression that you have to go on some kind of weekend like this in order to be initiated. He feels like God has been challenging him and in different ways all through his life and is constantly still initiating men, which I think is absolutely true.
Yeah.
And so usually my question for somebody like that is, where's God initiating you? Like where are the challenges? Because if you are kind of sitting back, I do believe God's got challenges for us.
Yeah.
So where is the challenge for you that you may be avoiding? This to me though is where it's more powerful. This is why I love and preach doing life with other men, with men doing life with other men, getting together in groups where there's a place where we can be accepted for who we are, where we can be really seen fully and know, hey, whatever's going on in my life, this is a group of people that are going to accept me for this and give me grace for it. Mm. At the same time, to learn safe ways to challenge each other where we see each other holding back or not addressing something in our life.
Yeah. So the person who is resistant to slowing down for a moment of pause, mm-hmm. The thing to get curious about is what message comes online if you don't get this done?
If you don't do it right.
And it sounds like what you're saying, that the flip is, let's say you're really comfortable with that quiet, still slowness. It sounds like the question is, are there people in your life who know what God is doing in you because you're in community with them?
Yeah.
Because like the danger of the go, go, go is inevitable burnout. You know, it's what I try to avoid on the show, like that spiritual exhaustion,
yep.
where rest doesn't do anything anymore, you know, and there's one of my friends told me he thinks that burnout is God's way of forcing a Sabbath on us, knowing that you will not take a rest. So he's going to allow you to burn out because it'll force a Sabbath. Like, that's hey, cool. You're not listening to me, so I'm going to let you burn out here. But what you're talking about is like when you're watching men do life with other men, there is a communal antidote even to jar you out of that almost complacency and stillness. Because like you can't know. I'm not doing a good articulating it, but when you were saying it, I got the sense of to the person who is all too comfortable with the quiet stillness and not doing things. The question is, do you have community?
Yeah, let me back up a second because I think the community piece works on both sides.
Yes,
for the guy who's going, having community.
He needs community.
Hey, by the way, you might want to stop for a second.
Yeah, you need community on both.
Yeah.
But I think the person who's really good at being still and quiet alone, my judgment is they might not be as willing to go talk about what God is teaching them with other people.
True.
And then it becomes like this isolated, God is in my own head, but I'm not hearing the voice of God through other people who are challenging me, pushing me. That isolationist
type. Yeah, I think the question for the guy who might be sitting on his hands, or you know, the question that's coming up. This is just off top of my head.
Well,
but is more around like, is there something you're avoiding?
Whoa, yeah. Is there something you're avoiding?
And the community piece to it is, it takes a lot of kind of self discipline or real just plain old honesty to be able to answer questions on either side.
Yeah.
Really well, and to have that much self-awareness.
Yeah.
Because if there is something we're avoiding, I'm going to find my way to way to convince myself that no, I'm just being spiritual.
Yeah. And this, you know, I'm trying to connect the dots here, but that's where practice enables you to better
absolutely
take time to answer those questions. If the first time you're asking that question is when you're on the brink of like destruction or burnout, mm-hmm, have you had practice to own? Have you had practice of like noticing what your body is telling you? And if you don't, you're not going to know, and then you're going to end up burning out.
Right. I think the practice, and I really appreciate you looping this back because it was a reason I wanted to go down this road in the first place, is that I think the practice gets us to that place of self-honesty.
Well,
that the more we're doing these things, the more we're able to be still, the more we're able to especially get to that place of getting our identity more aligned with this is who I am in Christ. So mm-hmm, any of this other stuff, it's great, I get to do it and everything, but it's not who I am. And if it all goes away, I'm not going to end up in a midlife crisis. I'm not going to end up wondering who I am or who my identity is. This is all solid.
Yeah.
And that helps us to get to a place of greater honesty with, okay, so is there a place I really need to be challenged? Is there something mm-hmm I'm avoiding? Is there something that I'm looking at? And be honest with it rather than kind of convincing myself, I really do want to keep avoiding this, so I just mm-hmm I'm gonna do this. Or I don't want to slow down because if I slow down, I might have to look at this part of myself I don't want to look at. So let's just keep going really fast.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, both are self-protective measures. Yeah. Hey, thanks for listening. That was part one of my two-part conversation with Chris Mosier. Be sure to check back in next week as we wrap up the dialogue with the remaining 40 to 45 minutes left we have on the dialogue. So grateful for you. Please be sure to rate, review, retweet, repost, do whatever to help spread the word about this White Flag community. And I hope you are well and in good health. I'll see you guys again next week. Peace.